Welcome to Food Talk Radio. I'm Brian Smith. In a couple weeks, I plan on grabbing a glass of eggnog and sitting down with a plate of cheese and crackers with a good book. But do you ever wonder all the rules and regulations that go into getting that dairy to your plate? Well, this month we take a look at dairy from three perspectives. First, Will Duane sits down with Steve Judge of Bob White Systems and talks about his experience and how he sees his role in helping to make milk local. Then Emily Lane interviews Professor Loader to discover what ag gag laws are. Then we finish with an opinion piece by local lawyer and vegan activist Eric Phillips Nania, who gives his perspective on dairy. But first, these headlines by Emily Lane and Emily Lyons.
Hello, this is Emily.
And Emily.
Welcome to Food and Agriculture News. Here's what's been happening internationally, nationally, and locally here in Vermont. Food and how it is grown has a lot to do with climate change. Industrial agriculture produces around a quarter to a third of the world's food and emits around a quarter of the world's greenhouse gases.
Early in November, the 19th Conference of the Parties, more commonly known as COP19, within the United Nations Framework Climate Change Conventions, being held in Warsaw, Poland, began. Countries are debating how to address the rapid climate change which is occurring. The Global Forum on Landscapes has discussed that agriculture is the basic means of subsistence in the countryside all over the world, and has a great significance for the achievement of the future Sustainable Development Goals. Unfortunately, according to estimates, agriculture is a direct cause of 80% of deforestation all over the world.
During COP19, Yeb Sano pledged that he would refrain from eating at the convention until a meaningful outcome is in sight. This hunger strike highlights the devastation in the Philippines, coinciding with the beginning of COP19 was Typhoon Haiyan, and made more evident the need for climate justice.
According to the Food and Agriculture Organization's Fisheries and Aquatic Technical Paper, number 553, private standards and related certification schemes are becoming significant features of international fish trade and marketing.
According to the FAO, food commodity markets are becoming more balanced and less price volatile than in recent years, thanks to improved supplies and a recovery in global inventory of cereals. The FAO Food Price Index, also published in this report, rose slightly in October, averaging 205.8 points.
In national news, the Food and Drug Administration recently announced its preliminary determination that partially hydrogenated oil is no longer generally recognized as safe for use in food. If this preliminary determination is finalized, foods containing partially hydrogenated oils are subject to pre-market review and approval by the FDA before they are sold to consumers.
Many organic farmers are angry with the Food and Drug Administration's attempt to limit the use of manure. Under the FDA food safety regulations, organic farmers would be required to limit their use of animal manure because of the disease-causing microbes such as Salmonella and E. coli that are commonly found in manure. Manure is an essential source of fertilizer for most organic farmers as they do not use industrial sources of nutrients.
Time is quickly running out to write a new $5 billion U.S. farm policy this year.
$500 billion.
I know, I suck. Time is quickly running out to write a new $500 billion U.S. farm policy this year. The major points of discussion during the Farm Bill Conference are the proposed cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, farm subsidies, dairy pricing reform, and cuts to conservation programs.
Some critiques of SNAP feel that Some critics of the SNAP debate feel that the focus needs to be on food equality. They state that food equality is a lever we can use to employ that will forever change... Oh God, now I've got the bug. Some critics of the SNAP debate feel that the focus needs to be on food equality. They state that food equality is a lever we can employ to forever change the face of poverty in the United States. all families, regardless of income, should have the same access to fresh, affordable food. Investing in programs that put wholesome food on tables of all Americans, regardless of income, would result in greater productivity and greatly reduce healthcare costs.
The Environmental Working Group and other organizations are calling for subsidy reform. The federal government paid $11.3 million in subsidies from 1995 to 2012. All of this money went to 50 billionaires or businesses in which they have some form of ownership.
There has also been a lot of discussion during the Farm Bill conference about the so-called King Amendment. This amendment attempts to prohibit a state from excluding lawfully produced agricultural products from other states being sold within its borders. It would prohibit a state from adopting laws regulating agricultural products produced by its own farmers and ranchers. Animal welfare and food security advocates fear the amendment would wipe out dozens of state laws that regulate animal welfare, child labor, environmental regulation, etc.
Here in Vermont, the Agency of Agriculture will now publish online a list of consumer protection violations. Vermonters now have access to the list of entities in violation of the consumer protection regulations enforced by the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets.
A new documentary, Cow Power, features Vermont's dairy digester efforts to save family farms and the environment. Vermont citizens have begun a sustainable energy program using power from manure to make electricity from methane digestion. Vermont now has more digesters per capita than any other state.
The Three Squares Vermont food stamp program that has recently been plagued by high error rates in recent years will be penalized for the third year in a row. The penalty of $370,000 is for failing to accurately distribute food benefits.
Don't forget to check out the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems labeling website, where you can see by hovering your mouse over the various parts of a label, what it really means. This can be found at foodlabelfacts.org. That's all for Food and Ag News. Check back for more updates.
Here with Steve Judge at Bob White Systems in downtown South Royalton. Steve, you want to just tell us a little bit about, I was reading your article, the letter that you had submitted, and you said you had about 40 years experience in the dairy industry in Vermont?
Well, not in Vermont entirely. I started in Massachusetts, in eastern Mass, at a small 40-cow Jersey farm and when I was 12, so it's actually been about 50 years.
Cool. So in your piece that you had written, you brought up something that I had no idea about, but that we currently are in the productionist or producerist?
Yeah, it's a what we are is a production-based dairy economy, and our focus is on having a almost a constant surplus of inexpensive milk for the customer base, which is largely urban, as opposed to a producer-based dairy economy that's in Canada, where their focus is on making sure that the dairy farmers get a good price and that they control the supply of milk. So the focus up there is on the farmer. Down here, it's just on cheap milk. Mm-hmm.
And down here with the cheap milk model, it seems like everyone wins but the farmer.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
So, and also in your piece, you had
I would like to say that In many ways, the consumer loses, because as the dairy industry becomes industrialized, I'm convinced that the quality and the flavor of the milk that's being produced and sold is suffering.
Do you think in our classes, especially some of the new curriculum we have at the school, I'm in a class right now called Environmental Agricultural Law, and we talk about the sort of monopolization of farming and cows. What do you think leads to that lesser quality of milk? Just hormones, breeding, genetic treatment of the animals, the stress they go through?
The way it's processed on one hand and handled, I mean, it's shipped in massive volumes and produced in massive volumes, and there are minimum standards for quality, but there really aren't good incentives for improving the flavor. and really, since it's a food, it should be all about flavor. And the way it's processed and pumped, and it's the milk is basically deconstructed and then reconstructed according to consumer preferences, whether it's 1% or 2% or skim or whatever. And by the time it leaves the processing plant, it bears very little resemblance to the milk that came out of the cow.
And having the milk from your cows just up the road here in South Royalton, do you believe in sort of the terroir of milk? Do you know that term, like French wine term? There's like the notion that wines from certain regions are going to taste the way they taste because of the geography and the soil and what goes into them. And the cows, I've seen your cows firsthand. They're climbing up hills. They've got a, sort of a varying climate in what it is they're eating.
A little alpine.
Yeah, a little bit of alpine going on. I think that the milk and then the cheese from those cows certainly does have its own distinct flavor.
Well, I think that it's appropriate to compare the flavor of milk to the flavor of wine. It's really just as complex and it's really just as fragile, and it can be damaged by many, many factors. And a lot of those factors, that the whole flavor aspect has been ignored by the dairy industry for years and years, just simply because they want a good supply of cheap milk.
Yeah.
And if you talk to people in the commercial dairy industry, they'll say that, well, people have forgotten what good milk tastes like. And I think that the advantage of producing milk locally and keeping it for local markets is that you don't transport it on big trucks down highways. You know, those trucks are like big thermoses. Mm-hmm. They're not refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they can sit in the sun for days before they're unloaded. The pumps that are used are pretty harsh. They damage the fats. So if you can produce milk locally like I do for the community, you have a much better opportunity to protect the very delicate flavor of milk.
In your piece, you had stated one of the ways to sort of move forward and allow dairy farmers to kind of take control of the model that's going on would be for the Agency of Agriculture to release names for farmers to more easily communicate with each other, and not specifically to unionize, but to follow the model that the Canadian producers went and sort of come back to a producerist model. What? So let's suppose those names get released. What would be the next step? Are farmers, would it be a lobbying effort to sort of change the way it goes, or could they just, with a free market and taking a stand on how they want to run their businesses, would they be able to affect change that way?
Well, some people believe that the dairy industry in the United States saw what happened in Canada back in the 70s, where it was an evolving situation, but the dairy farmers there took control of their industry. They communicated with one another. They organized politically, and they said, "We're not just going to sell our milk through co-ops, and we're going to control the supply, and we're going to control the price." And concurrently, I think a lot of people believe that the dairy industry saw that up there and put on a tremendous lobbying effort, so that farmers' names couldn't be released, and to really keep them powerless politically. And people say, well, you have co-ops. Well, if I'm a member of a dairy co-op, I can't get a list of my fellow members. I can't even find out what management's being paid.
Wow.
In the case of Agrimark, that was taken all the way to the Supreme Court in the state here, or the top court in the state, and it was ruled that Agrimark members don't own the co-op, and so therefore they have no right to know for the membership or to know the membership or to know how much the management's being paid. They don't have any access to the books. So co-ops are good in that they're really good in utilizing milk. You know, they'll go, if I have a 40 cow farm, they'll be at my farm every other day picking up the milk, and it'll go and I don't have to worry about it. But they're terrible at getting good prices. You know, it's as if, and there are, you know, three or four big co-ops now. And it's like the coal mine
in the state?
In the area.
Greater New England, New York area?
Well, it's really nationalized now. You've got Dairy Farmers of America, and St. Albans Co-op is part of that. There's a lot of affiliated. It's really merged and kind of consolidated across the top, but they still do compete on the basis of price. And it would be like if I was a coal miner and I belonged to a union, and there were other unions that were competing to sell my coal at the lowest possible price. You know, I mean, they're competing. This doesn't make any sense.
No, not for you.
No, not for the farmer. No, yeah. And so that means because they have to utilize the milk the way they have to do, the co-ops have to come get it. They have to sell it. So their primary relationship really is with their customers. You know, they worry less about their and the with the downward pressure of the prices, they don't have to worry about production because production keeps going up mm-hmm. in response to the lower prices. So it's kind of insidious. So if you were to contact the Department of or the Agency of Agriculture and ask for a list of farmers that are licensed to ship milk in Vermont, they won't give it to you, and they say, well, that's because we don't want them to be bothered or privacy concerns or something like that. And but personally, I think it's more to keep the farmers in the dark about what's going on, prohibit them from organizing politically. We put together a little business back in the 90s, and we tried to send a letter out to all the dairy farmers in the state talking about what our intentions were, and you know, we had to go to all kinds of contortions to get, you know, the names of all the farmers that we could. And I think we got maybe 30 or 40%.
Wow.
And we sent out the letter, and we had a tremendous response. So I think the farmers are eager, but, you know, the traditional dairy farmer is disappearing pretty rapidly, so we may have missed the critical mass required to make those political changes. So I think a market response is more appropriate, and that's what I'm doing, promoting micro dairies.
So, yeah, it's a great segue to
The other thing I just want to add is it's also the response to the local food movement. A lot of times people think, well, dairy's so big, you can't have local dairy. But no, you can have local dairy. And a micro dairy is just the logical result of the consolidation of the commercial dairy industry. People want local foods, and you can do it with a micro dairy, you know. It's great. And if you want to go to another regulatory level, I think you can sell more milk and you can distribute it to your customers as well. But that requires another level of regulatory participation. But it's good. It's nice. It's great that, you know, Amy Schollenberger and rural Vermont really had a lot to do with the modern raw milk legislation, and she's done a great job, and other people have done a great job as well. So it's good that we have that available here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Sure.
So that would come before the numbers. Hello, this is Emily Lane. I'm here with Professor Lauder.
Hello, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Hello. Could you tell our listener a little bit about what you do here at Vermont Law School?
Yes, I teach a number of courses at Vermont Law School, including animal law and ethics and environmental ethics, and a course involving legal ethics for lawyers called Legal Profession. And I also teach first-year property law.
Great. So that would explain why you have such a wealth of knowledge about these ag-gag laws. And just for the listener who doesn't know what ag-gag is, let's explain at the outset what it is and how many types are there.
Well, ag-gag laws as a group are laws that are being considered or passed with the motivation to cut down on the amount of information that the public sees about what goes on in farms. These are private enterprises, and the public doesn't generally have access. And so one of the only ways that this information has come to the public attention is through undercover photographs and videos, either by people who have applied for employment but who are otherwise interested in documenting any abuse or neglect that they see, or people who genuinely want employment but are troubled by what they see and then decide to document it. So the laws are generally designed to either directly prevent people from taking such footage, which is one kind of law, probably the most extreme, or prohibiting people from applying for employment when they might have a different motive that is related to animal advocacy. So that would be the fraud in employment kind of approach. to the law. And then finally, there's the third kind of law, which is the one that most states are currently considering, which is a mandatory reporting kind of law that says if anyone observes animal neglect or cruelty, they are required to report that within a short period of time, say 1 to 3 days. Okay. So what those do is discourage someone who is on the inside from taking any kind of footage that would reveal a pattern or practice of abuse or neglect. And if you just film an isolated incident, the farmers are right to say it's impossible to completely prevent these things from happening, and you can't take out of context one event. So if you're required to report, chances are you will be quickly fired when you do, and therefore you're precluded from getting footage of a longer pattern.
So these kind of anti-whistleblowing and anti-undercover journalism laws are one of many obstacles faced by animal lawyers. Can you discuss what might be some other obstacles? Because it seems like the most productive and the best way to advocate for change is to tell people and open it up for public discussion and bring it into the discourse. And then the general will of the people will help enforce what the norm should be. So what are the other obstacles that they're up against? And why is this one of the last and best tactics that they could have used?
Well, this is the biggest problem that I see animal advocates facing in this country are the laws themselves. So one thing a lot of people don't realize is that there's no federal protection other than in the slaughter and transport to slaughter process for farm animals. They're actually excluded from the Federal Animal Welfare Act, which provides protection to animals as a whole. Okay, so that's something that people don't realize. Then you have every state has its own anti-cruelty laws. And the problem with those is that they only cover the most egregious abuses. Customary practices, which would include farming practices, are usually excluded from state protection. So the upshot is that farm animals are the real legal losers. They don't have the kind of protection that the public, I think, has a right to assume they do. So it's been a very important tool of animal advocates to precipitate changes in the law. And one of the strategies they've used for doing that is through undercover footage. So there's actually an example in California in 2008 where some undercover employees filmed the slaughter process in which cows that couldn't stand were being forced to stand through very cruel means just to enable them to go through the slaughter line. And the public outrage upon seeing this footage resulted in the largest meat recall in U.S. history. In California also, footage taken by the Humane Society of battery cages for hens, which are very small confinement cages, basically the size of a piece of typing paper to hold 3 or 4 hens. This footage really aroused the public so that they had a voter initiative. And now in California, battery cages will be banned as of 2015. So the footage has had a dramatic effect sometimes on the law, and therefore it's a really important strategy amongst others that animal welfare advocates have for precipitating changes.
Hi there. My name is Eric Phillips Nania. I'm a Vermont lawyer, and I have a strong interest in food and agricultural issues. I've been a vegetarian since I was 10 and vegan since 2007 for environmental, health, animal welfare, social justice, spiritual, and other reasons. As a vegan, I only eat plant-based foods and nothing from animals. I've also been growing a lot of my own food, and I'd love to talk here today in the next few minutes about a couple of issues in the dairy sector, which accounts for about 80% of Vermont's agricultural sales and is a staple for the average American, who consumes about 2 pounds of dairy a day, or 620 pounds a year, three times the world's average. The first issue is that dairy is not necessary for our diet and is actually harmful to our health. Numerous scientific studies, as reported in great books such as The China Study, The Food Revolution, and Becoming Vegan, show that dairy promotes disease and is strongly correlated with an increased risk in heart disease, diabetes, various cancers, including prostate, ovarian, and breast cancers, and it can even increase the risk for osteoporosis due to the hormones and acidic properties that undermine the body's utilization of calcium. Milk also generally contains many contaminants, such as hormones, pesticides, antibiotics, fungicides, heavy metals, and others, as toxins accumulate in fat, and milk is high in fat. Given this, why does the USDA's checkoff program provide over $280 million per year to aggressively promote milk with slogans like milk, it does a body good? Due to the hundreds of scientific studies and peer-reviewed journals that link meat and dairy to these numerous diseases, the industry is concerned about liability. The situation is comparable to the legal liability imposed on cigarette and asbestos companies for health injuries. This has inspired the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a conservative corporate lawmaker forum, to draft corporate-friendly legislation, namely the Common Sense Consumption Act, to exempt food producers from liability that their products cause. All in all, dairy is definitely not at all healthy for humans, and the best comprehensive resource for this is Whitewash, The Disturbing Truth About Cow's Milk and Your Health. In fact, the measurable external costs of animal products in general involves about $300 billion per year for healthcare costs, according to the new book Meatonomics by the lawyer David Simon. Compare that to the $65 billion annual medical costs in the U.S. directly attributable to smoking. And, of course, dairy is especially problematic for the animals. In terms of the cows themselves, the second issue is that despite the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, about 10 to 30% of dairy cows are not properly stunned. After about 3 to 4 years, dairy cows are turned into hamburger patties. While they're fully awake and conscious, these cows are regularly scalded, have their feet cut off, their bellies and rectum cut open, and are skinned alive. That's billions of dairy cows being skinned alive each year thanks to our appetite for dairy. It's a systematic nationwide problem, as documented in the book No Happy Cows. And there's no fine or penalty for these violations. The biggest enforcement problem is that industrial killing is driven by profit considerations rather than animal welfare, making it impractical or impossible to comply. Polls show that the vast majority of people are outraged and alarmed by these inhumane conditions. And don't think that places like Vermont are immune from this. In 2009, the Humane Society, with an undercover investigation, documented shocking animal abuse in a Vermont dairy. Beyond the animal welfare issues, beyond the hundreds of billions of dollars of health issues, and even beyond the substantial economic pessimism within the industry, there are issues of fundamental justice. The milk mustache hides the sickening truth. It's theft. We're stealing the milk from the calves, and we're stealing the calves from their enslaved mothers. How can we hope for peace and justice when we deny it to others and ingest the products of violence, exploitation, and death? As the fantastic book The World Peace Diet illuminates, the web of connections involves vast negative ailments. Perhaps most importantly is the loss of our sensitivity to the beauty, the sacredness, and the interconnectedness of life. We need to rethink our consumption of dairy and meat, even from small-scale local farms. Our consumption of dairy renders our efforts for peace and justice hypocritical and doomed to failure. But what's more lawful than eating meat or drinking milk? And yet, what's more destructive to virtue than this normalized indulgence of exploitation, contributing to the traumatic social and environmental crises. If we want to be healthy, if we want to evolve to higher levels of understanding and compassion, if we want a cultural evolution towards peace, sustainability, spiritual maturity, and justice, then we need to speak truth to power, rid our minds of these false, infantile appetites, and stop consuming dairy. With so many reasons for not consuming dairy, the question is not why vegan, but why are you still drinking milk?